Some voices in this podcast were generated by AI for additional diversity. Rest assured, everything has been translated, edited, and voiced by humans for quality assurance. Enjoy the show.
Kyiv will stand as long as Chernihiv stands. As long as Kyiv stands, Ukraine keeps fighting.
This quote from Taras Shumut, founder of the Come Back Alive Foundation, captures the essence of the predicament of the Ukrainian Defense Forces in Chernihiv. On the morning of the 24th of February 2022, convoys of Russian military vehicles and hardware, stretching out for dozens of kilometers, were easy to spot on satellite images of Russian territory right on the other side of the Ukrainian border on the eve of Russia's full-scale invasion. On the morning of the 24th of February, all of that hardware was unleashed upon Ukraine, where it was met by the 1st Tank Brigade, largely unaided except by several smaller units. But somehow, the Ukrainian forces were able to engage and indeed stop the Russian army. The Kharkiv Defense Forces pulled off a similarly miraculous feat, stopping the Russian invasion on the eastern stretch of the Northern Front. Ukrainska Pravda presents the final episode of our series 2402, The Invasion Reconstructed, which tells the story of day one of Russia's full-scale invasion. This episode recounts how Ukrainian troops, far outnumbered by the Russian occupation forces, managed to hold on to the cities of Chernihiv and Kharkiv and the Donbass front. Yet the Ukrainian defenses in the south of the country crumbled despite facing what appeared to be very similar circumstances. No matter how many days an invader thinks it will take them to conquer Kyiv, doing so is almost impossible without capturing Chernihiv. Just like it was in the days of Kyiv and Rus, the original Ukrainian kingdom, when Kyiv and Chernihiv were among the most powerful principalities from the 9th to 13th centuries, the Russian forces were going to turn Chernihiv into their logistics hub. Alexander, an officer at Operational Command North, told Suspilne about the city's importance.
Holding Chernihiv allowed us to maintain control over the main approaches to Kyiv from the north and east. Consider the distance from which military supplies are delivered to combat units. The Brovary group of Russian forces, which advanced from Konotop and through Stepkino, had to have supplies delivered from 300 kilometers away. You'd need a lot of vehicles to get enough stuff for a 15,000 to 20,000 strong group of forces with between 3,000 and 6,000 units of equipment to carry on intensive combat operations. Capturing Chernihiv would have cut that distance in half. If the Russians had controlled the E95 MO1 road, they would have been able to fight more effectively around Kyiv.
As on the other fronts where Russian forces were advancing, here the Ukrainian forces, both personnel and equipment, were far outnumbered. Leonid Koda, commander of the 1st Separate Sivershina Tank Brigade, told journalists that this forced his unit to resort to some creative tactics.
We were able to deviate a bit from the defense plan, thank God. However hard it is to admit this, we simply weren't fit or equipped to fight against such a huge horde, such a big number, such an enemy. They would have just crushed us and entered Chernihiv. That's why we had to force them to disperse and fight where we wanted to fight them. Yes, they were bombing Chernihiv, but we needed them to get further away from the borders and closer to us. When the enemy is that powerful, you have to fight them on your territory and even surrender some of it. You have to get them out of their comfort zone and inflict damage on smaller groups here and there, gradually depleting their combat units.
That's what Valery Zaluzhny, Ukraine's then commander-in-chief, meant when he told Time magazine that spilling the Russians' blood was one of Ukraine's strategic goals.
On all the other vectors, we had to spill their blood, even if in some places it would require losing territory. In other words, the aim was to allow the Russians to advance and then destroy their columns in the front and supply lines in the rear.
That's why the fighting on the Chernihiv front took place so close to the city itself. This is how Viktor Nikoliuk, commander of Operational Command North, who was in charge of Chernihiv's defense, recounted the first day of fighting.
The first battles commenced, and I was in Karnatop, a city in Sumy Oblast, northeastern Ukraine, where the Russians started to advance. That's where Ukraine's 1st Tank Brigade was based. They were supposed to go to Rybki, 35 kilometers from Chernihiv, but didn't make it in time. They've ended in Halyavin, 10 kilometers north of Chernihiv, where the first battles took place. We damaged 5 enemy tanks right away, and several pieces of our equipment were damaged as well. The Russians tried to encircle a company on the left flank, but the company got away. The brigade commander made the right decision. He saved people's lives by getting the Russian forces to come several kilometers closer and then carrying out a counterattack. That's how people were saved. We lost 2 or 3 pieces of equipment, but the enemy lost more. We neutralized almost an entire company. The enemy retreated, but then they started to attack again. That's how it went.
Commander Nikoliuk, who was directly involved in the fighting over the next few days, says Ukraine's 58th Motorized Infantry Brigade was waiting for the Russians on the main road not far from Gluhiv.
We'd inflicted damage on the Russian forces, but the enemy convoy was still continuing to advance. Why did that happen? Because they started driving right over civilian cars. But we stopped them near Karnatop. Tanks and infantry got involved, and the 58th Brigade sustained losses and was forced to retreat. The 1st Tank Brigade, on the other hand, got entrenched near Chernihiv and remained there.
Civilians contributed enormously to the city's defense. Nikoliuk remembers several incidents particularly vividly.
And of course, I have huge respect for the locals who shared important information with us, who destroyed road signs so that enemy forces couldn't tell where they were going, who blocked roads and made Molotov cocktails, and who drained petrol from cars and petrol stations. It's a story that needs to be told separately. We get reports about groups of enemy forces appearing here and there. That allowed us to target our attacks and inflict real damage on Russian forces. Once we were told that a train carrying around 20 tanks of petrol had pulled into one of the stations and wasn't being guarded. They said they could drain the fuel. Well, I gave the order, and I told them to at least capture it on video. They sent me a photo. There were, I believe, around 100 people there, some on tractors, some in horse-drawn wagons, some on motorbikes. They were all smiling as they drained that fuel.
Ukraine's pre-war plans had envisioned that Chernihiv's defense line would run along the Rybki-Horodnia axis, around 35 kilometers from the border with Belarus. However, the Russian troops' rapid advance meant that they weren't stopped until they got to the Veliki-Oznikiye-Sedniv axis, only 20 to 25 kilometers from Chernihiv. Although the Russian forces captured most of the Chernihiv Oblast, they were not able to capture the city's administrative center. Chernihiv survived horrific bombardments and relentless artillery shelling, but after 1 month, 1 week, and 2 days, the Russians were pushed back from the city. Their forced retreat was one of Russia's first so-called goodwill gestures towards Ukraine. The Russians had assumed that Kharkiv Oblast and the city of Kharkiv itself would be easy prey. Oleksandr Pivnenko, who was commander of the Ukrainian National Guard's 3rd Rapid Response Brigade when the full-scale invasion began and took part in the defense of Kharkiv, said the Russians weren't expecting to meet resistance.
We intercepted a convoy of riot police units of Russia's National Guard. They had batons and shields in their trucks. Where did they think they were going? They thought everyone would surrender and come out to greet them with flowers. That didn't happen.
Lieutenant Colonel Petro Vitushko of the 92nd Brigade said the Ukrainian military started to think about the defense of Kharkiv Oblast after Valery Zaluzhny was appointed as commander-in-chief of the armed forces in July 2021.
I was promoted to officer before his appointment, and I was very glad to see the changes that came in with Zaluzhny's arrival. It was the first time anyone had considered the defense of Kharkiv Oblast.
Russian forces had carried out frequent false flag operations on the Russian-Ukrainian border in Kharkiv Oblast, even before the full-scale invasion. The Ukrainian armed forces were forced to respond to their attacks, if only to signal their presence in the area, even though there were not enough forces to cover the entire 100-kilometer stretch of the border. Vitushko recalled,
mechanized battalions would form convoys and drive back and forth near the border so that it would look as if there were a lot of us and we were on the move, maneuvering. We were training in areas that we now know enemy forces would march into just a week or two later.
The 92nd Brigade started preparing for the worst-case scenario, a Russian invasion, before it had begun, Vitushko recalled.
All the equipment from the bases that were hit on the very first day of the full-scale invasion was moved beforehand. The vehicles were loaded up with personnel and ammunition. We got to the front-line command post well ahead of time. The battalions took up their position as determined by the brigade commander. We anticipated the Russians' actions, but we didn't know when the invasion would begin. We needed at least 3 days to fully prepare for the events that eventually unfolded, to take up defensive positions. Unfortunately, we ran out of time. The brigade commander ordered us to rig the bridges between us and the Russian border with explosives a day, maybe a day and a half, before the Russian invasion. That was a very timely decision. We were also ordered to deploy mechanized battalions, squads or platoons, to strengthen the bridge's defense. Those were the first guys to meet the Russian forces. They were the ones who held them back.
Vitushko says that on the 24th of February, there was no plan for the defense of Kharkiv.
All of us in the operational unit, as well as the officers with combat experience from 2014 and 2015, presented our plan to the Kharkiv city government, but they didn't approve it. We took into account Kharkiv's large garrison, its rivers and streets, and the fact that the shortest route to Kharkiv was 25 kilometers long. We were interested in coming up with a plan, but no plan was in place on the 24th of February. The beginning of the war was chaotic.
Even the bold plans prepared by the military proved insufficient in the face of the Russian forces advancing on Kharkiv from Russia's Belgorod Oblast, just over the border.
Enemy forces were advancing en masse. We weren't expecting that. We thought they might advance on the Kupiansk front, closer to the Joint Forces Operation demarcation line. We couldn't imagine the scale of the invasion, that enemy forces would advance on the Kharkiv front via Lipetsy, Bohodukhiv, and Zolochiv. We had battalions there, we had artillery, we had various units, but the Russians advanced at such a pace that we couldn't stop them. In some places, they were just barged through our combat formations. It all happened really fast.
Soldiers were advancing from Russia towards Kharkiv. They planned to occupy the city in 2 days and sought to destroy the 92nd Mechanized Brigade, which was defending the city. The first Russian missiles were pointed at the brigade's base in the city of Chuhuiv. Although they were outnumbered, the fighters of the 92nd Brigade held a 100-kilometer-long front. Lieutenant Colonel Vitushko recalls,
if the enemy had realized how weak we were, how few of us there were, and how little equipment and personnel we had, they would have pressed on. But we conducted decoy actions. We made our presence felt even though there were only 150 of us. We had no effective weapons, but we steadily fired 82-millimeter bombs from the one mortar we had. It's a pretty poor weapon, yet the enemy fled.
The Russians attacked Kharkiv from several fronts at once, and the numerically smaller Ukrainian garrison encountered them almost everywhere.
The first place the enemy swiftly reached was the district road, and they set up a checkpoint there. The 22nd Motorized Infantry Battalion, led by the battalion commander, deputy and chief of staff, with a small number of fighters, 20 people and two tanks, recaptured the checkpoint, wiped out the enemy, forced them to retreat from Kharkiv to a distance of 1 or 1.5 kilometers, and then kept the enemy at a distance for many months.
In some areas, the Ukrainian armed forces faced serious problems. One unit near Liptsy, a village close to the Russian border, was surrounded. A company commander from the 92nd Brigade, whose alias is Best, told us,
I was informed that our company had been encircled. I decided that around 11 a.m. to withdraw from our positions, regroup, and break through to the outskirts of Kharkiv to prevent the enemy from advancing further and basically stop them from entering the city. As we were withdrawing, we came upon an enemy convoy and battle ensued. We didn't leave with the entire company, only two vehicles. The Russians captured our other two vehicles. When I heard this, there was only one thing to do: go and rescue our boys.
Commander Oleksandr Pivnenko recalled another revealing episode that happened that day.
We got a message from the duty officers that the Russians had attacked the northern part of the city with a Smerch multiple launch rocket system. An advanced group was there monitoring the north and the road leading to the village of Hoptivka. We told the instructors, group commanders and their soldiers to change into civilian clothes and tasked them with heading north to see where the combat zone and the enemy were, so I could get an idea of how much time I had.
Pivnenko says the situation was already pretty good in the north of Kharkiv Oblast. The soldiers of the 92nd Brigade took up positions and began their defense near the settlement of Kozachalopan, on the border with Russia. Pivnenko ordered the soldiers to investigate the situation around Kharkiv and all fronts of the possible offensive.
Just then, I received a command from the chief of the Eastern Territorial Administration to help some of our tanks in the village of Tsirkuni.
Pivnenko recalls,
I took three 4E Bucephalus armored personnel carriers, an aerial reconnaissance vehicle, and a Cougar command car, and our convoy sped over to the crossroads on the Tsirkuni front. We drove at 100 to 110 kilometers an hour. We were just coming up to the crossroads. At the time, I thought they were still ours.
But right there was the first tank of the Russian advance group, which would have been followed by a convoy of Russian vehicles.
And we sped straight over to their checkpoint. Our armored personnel carriers didn't let us down either. The first one destroyed the tank, and the next one destroyed all the combat equipment. The enemy fled in the direction it had come from, and that's how we stopped the first tanks from entering the city.
Despite their massive advantage in terms of manpower and equipment, the tense situation, and their successful breakthrough of the defenses on the approach to Kharkiv, the Russians did not break into the city on the 24th of February. The tanks and sabotage groups that did manage to enter the city in the following days of February, as they'd wanted to do originally, stayed in Kharkiv for good. But there was a catch. Unable to occupy Kharkiv, the Russians began to destroy it, launching daily artillery and missile attacks. Horrific as this was, Taras Chmut says, the critical thing here was that the city did not surrender.
Kharkiv is 30 kilometers away from the border, or 50 if you count from the city center, and the Russians hadn't been able to enter it. The 92nd Brigade, the National Guard, border guards, cadets, students, and local people burned 20,000 of their convoys, destroyed them, and so on. Yes, there were significant losses, but Kharkiv held out. They didn't expect the front line and the troops in the east, in Kherson Oblast, and in the north, to stand firm and hold out till the end. They weren't able to take any city immediately, apart from Kherson.
The story of Ukraine's defense on the 24th of February is all about how just one more day was needed for preparation, and how small heroic units can stop a whole horde. A small mobile defense was able to overcome the Russian convoys in the north, the Polesian forest and the Pripyat marshes, because of the terrain and their local knowledge. But the defense forces of the south, with roughly the same ratio of invaders to defenders, but in the middle of the wide-open Kherson steppe, essentially had no chance.
When the invasion happened, we'd just come back from a work trip to Kherson. And when I was in Kherson, I jumped into the car with my boys in the morning and drove along the administrative border with occupied Crimea to see what was happening.
Serhii Pritula recalls.
And I talked with the border guards. I asked them, "What's the situation, guys?" "Everything's fine," they answered. "We don't see any movement from their side, but we are ready." And I asked, "What have you done to prepare?" Because there were no trench systems or fortifications. I asked, "Is there anyone else or is it just you?" They told me which intelligence unit was deployed there. I knew which other units there might be and how far away they were. But it was clear that a military force that could have stopped this invasion was just not there. And later, when I talked with the guys from the Special Operations Forces, they said, "We just sat and watched as four rows of Russian tanks sped along this road from Simferopol to Melitopol, and we realized that there was no way to stop them."
The man in charge of Ukrainian defense on the Crimean front was Major General Andriy Sokolov. Sokolov was appointed commander of Operational Command South in the autumn of 2021. He tried to provide combat training and coordination to both the headquarters staff and the personnel available to him. But the resources at his disposal weren't even enough to properly run routine peacetime operations, let alone repel a full-scale invasion.
"The southern group worked on a rotational basis,"
General Sokolov said in an interview with Ukrainska Pravda.
"Meaning that some people would come and then be replaced by other people. Considering the total number of combat units at the time of the invasion, there were about 1,500 people. Specifically, the 59th Brigade had roughly 1,300 personnel. Why so few? Because the brigade had left the Donbass in December and was restoring its combat capability. That recovery process had not yet been completed when they were assigned to our group. They were moved to the Oleshky Sands training ground. The brigade was about 60% staffed. The artillery was also understaffed because two divisions had been exercising at the Divichki training ground in Kiev Oblast. And the engineering support group, or sappers, had been undergoing training in Kamianets-Podilsky. In addition, there were about 250 people in the 137th Marine Battalion, which was also at 50% strength. Some of these 250 people were conscripts engaged in stabilization operations on the border with Crimea." "What are stabilization operations? They were stretched out over an area up to 200 kilometers long, at observation posts along the entire border, monitoring the Russians' activities to ensure there were no illegal crossings. And only a tiny proportion of them, about one platoon or 15 to 45 people, were located at the strong point directly in front of the Chonhar Bridge. Before you got to the platoon, there was a strong point near the Kalanchak checkpoint too. Another platoon strong point was near the village of Kairi at the Chaplinka checkpoint opposite the Titan chemical plant. Three strong points, that was what the enemy first encountered on day one of the war." "It obviously wasn't sufficient even for a stabilization operation. During escalation, the plan was to have up to two brigades, one on the Kherson front to carry out tasks and stabilization activities, and one on the Melitopol front. One battalion was to stand directly on the border as a forward unit. I didn't even have those forces. I only had one brigade. There were no forces at all on the Melitopol front. I sent my reserve there, a tank company, to cover it somehow. The two brigades were assigned to us for stabilization operations in the event that the enemy began to take action from Crimea, as it did in the Donbass in 2014, using civilians as a shield, sending in sabotage and reconnaissance groups and some detachments under a foreign flag.
In the event of full-fledged open hostilities, General Sokolov said, they had an even more powerful plan.
But there was a separate plan for defense. That involved four brigades, two mechanized combined arms brigades, and two territorial defense forces brigades. That's right. The plan called for four brigades, yet I only got one in reality. This obviously wasn't enough. I couldn't rely on the territorial defense forces at all, as we never got them. There were supposed to be two brigades, Kherson and Zaporizhia. At the start of the war, these brigades existed only on paper. An order had never gone out for them to be staffed, sent to us, and deployed. I assumed command of the Zaporizhia 110th Territorial Defense Brigade at the end of the day on the 24th of February.
You can certainly debate what happened in the Kherson region, but we had been on that front since the summer and tried to work with the military there. There really were very few personnel.
According to Taras Chimbut, founder of the Comeback Alive Foundation.
Why was there a lack of personnel? Because there weren't enough people in the army. No matter what people may tell you, there was only one brigade there. Although the 137th Brigade did have a lot of additional personnel and reinforcements, we did not have enough people to hold such an immensely long line, and increasing the army to 300,000 to 350,000 personnel would have meant a significant increase in the budget. But the president had a different vision. That's why what happened happened. But we would have been totally defeated if the military had not prepared.
General Sokolov recalls that his 59th Brigade received an order to leave the training ground in Oleshki on the 23rd of February, but on the morning of the invasion, most of it was still there. The brigade attempted to organize a defense in Oleshki, but the Russians advanced with such force and speed that there was no chance to defend it, and the brigade retreated toward Kherson. The Russian troops had gained operational space for a considerable advance. Their convoys came to a halt that evening on the approaches to Melitopol, presumably because they had simply run out of fuel. At this point, Sokolov made one last attempt to save the day.
By the end of the 24th, we were given reinforcements, a National Guard regiment, a public order patrol unit, and the 110th Brigade of the Territorial Defense Forces. We tried to gain a foothold. No one was controlling Melitopol at the time, so enemy troops were able to approach the outskirts of the city. We managed to fire on some Russian convoys. Our Hurricane multiple launch rocket systems did a good job, firing on an enemy convoy. At night, we marched from Basilivka and entered Melitopol. Unfortunately, the forces we had, two incomplete National Guard battalions, were not enough. The 110th Brigade didn't enter Melitopol because they didn't even have any equipment. Unfortunately, we weren't able to hold Melitopol. Melitopol was, as they say, there for the taking. Anyone could have taken it over. There was no organized resistance, no defense. The enemy entered Melitopol, and the National Guard units had to withdraw from the city. We later organized the defense along the Basilivka-Tokmak axis, but we couldn't hold it with the forces we had. So we retreated further to the village of Kamyanske, I think, upstream from Basilivka, where we finally gained a foothold.
At about the same time, Russian convoys were approaching Kherson, taking control of two key crossings of the Dnipro River, the Antonivka Bridge and the Novokakhovka Dam. The failure of the defense of the south created threats on another front, in the Joint Forces Operation area and near Mariupol. This was perhaps the only part of the front where Russia's full-scale offensive was actually expected and well prepared for, as Ukraine had some very capable units deployed there. General Oleksandr Pavliuk, then commander of the Joint Forces, recollects,
"We expected that there would be an offensive. We thought that if there was, it would primarily be against the Joint Forces group, the most combat-ready units on a territory of Ukraine at the time, and we were preparing for that. 3 months before the full-scale invasion, all positions were equipped and fortified, barriers had been built on all roads, and measures had been taken to withdraw troops from under attack. We were all dispersed. All the reserves had changed positions, and so had all the command posts, and a lot of false strong points had been set up.
According to Taras Chmut, founder of the Come Back Alive Foundation, the Ukrainian army prepared for the war with the personnel it had.
Commander-in-Chief Zaluzhny and I saw each other every 3 days, every 2 days, as if we were working together. There were plans, there was detailed intelligence information on enemy groups, what, where, and where from. The military was preparing its personnel to counteract potential scenarios. The question was, which scenarios? I'm not sure that everyone believed in the scenario that would actually end up happening. An attempt by the Russians to enter across the border of Donetsk and Luhansk Oblast was the most obvious one. Those two regions had been fully incorporated into Russia, so now something was bound to start. Joint Forces Commander Oleksandr Pavlyuk, a hero of Ukraine, was one of the appointments we were very lucky to have. He was preparing to hold a solid defense there and fight.
We realized there would be a strike on the flanks, a pincer movement, so we concentrated our main reserves on the Mariupol and Luhansk fronts,
General Pavlyuk says.
It worked out as planned. That's why day one, the first large-scale attacks they planned, did not go well. I mean, even the first missile strike that hit my command posts, all the people were in shelters, we didn't lose control. Only the buildings were destroyed. The rest of the units also performed their tasks very well, even though Luhansk Oblast was surrounded on three sides, and many units were at risk of being encircled. But everything was quickly regrouped. Our group was cut off and encircled, and then destroyed. So the strike overwhelmed and disarmed us. And that was the strike towards Mariupol. They launched everything they could in between Mariupol and Volnovakha. We destroyed most of the Russian corps there. But the strike from the west, from Melitopol, still managed to cut Mariupol off from the main forces. We regrouped and prepared one brigade for a counterattack to create a corridor, but, well, this decision saved the whole south, because the Russians redirected the entire group that was going to attack Nikolaev and Odessa and sent it to stop us breaking through to Mariupol.
The name Mariupol was destined to become a symbol of untold suffering, unprecedented war crimes, and the incredible resilience of the Ukrainian army. What makes all the suffering that this city and dozens of others have endured even more horrific is the realization that the Ukrainian command had accurately anticipated Russia's plans. General Sokolov recounts,
"We were expecting it because we had considered the possibility of an attack from the south during our training for commanders and in military exercises. They acted in line with our expectations. Their first objective was to capture the bridges and crossings over the Dnipro River. Their second objective was to capture Melitopol in advance on Mariupol to create a land corridor. They did exactly what we expected. We didn't have enough personnel or resources. When the war started, we had only our peacetime staff. No additional military groups were created. We just had what we had."
Perhaps one of the most horrifying things about the war that engulfed the whole of Ukraine on the 24th of February was that there seemed to be no safe place left in the country, vast though it is. Many people, especially those who faced the threat of imminent occupation, felt that the only way to escape was to go to the west of the country. Chernivtsi, Zakarpattia, and Lviv oblasts began to accept and accommodate hundreds of thousands of people on an emergency basis. From the morning of the 24th of February, Lviv railway station became a symbol of day one of the full-scale invasion, a place everyone wanted to reach and from which everyone was trying to escape to somewhere else, somewhere safer. Lviv Mayor Andriy Sadovy recalls,
"До війни завершили реконструкцію площі перед вокзалом. We had completed the reconstruction of the square in front of the railway station before the full-scale war. If that hadn't been done, the scene would have been like Armageddon. There was plenty of space to put the necessary information points in. We also scaled up the work done by the staff of the station itself. The station manager is a young man who hasn't been completely initiated into Ukrainian railways system. So flexible solutions were adopted quickly enough to allow people to wait for their trains for Poland to arrive. There was also a link to Poland via bus routes. Many people stayed in Lviv, so people knew where to go. The system worked. To give you an idea, more than 5 million people passed through during this time.
Various international organizations that were set up to help in situations like this simply disappeared from view for a long time. When things got tough, Ukrainians had to save themselves without any outside help, both on the battlefield and in the rear.
That's the initial impression we got from February and March 2022 onwards, that all the international organizations had fled Ukraine, especially those that were supposed to help in difficult times, including helping refugees. We were constantly giving briefings here in the courtyard of the Lviv City Hall, and I addressed one of those briefings exclusively to the international community. I said, "Hello, where are you? You're funded by the United Nations, by various international organizations. Come, we are waiting for you. We need you." And sometime after that, they did start to appear, but only gradually, because the international community was not ready. They all thought it would somehow be over very quickly and there would be no need to deploy any staff.
On a small rocky piece of land in the Black Sea near Odessa, no war was expected on the 22nd or 23rd of February. There were no suspicious movements by Russian forces on Zmiini, or Snake Island, on the eve of the invasion.
Nothing much was happening then. I remember that a Russian military aircraft flew very low over us about 2 weeks before, but nothing unusual had happened since.
Bohdan Hotsky, the commander of the border guard post on Zmiini, recounts. The full-scale war came to the island at around 3 a.m. on the 24th of February with the voice of a Russian warship. Russians claimed that the area around Zmiini Island was mined and demanded that civilian vessels change course. It wasn't until 6 a.m. that the Russians addressed the defenders of Zmiini Island for the first time. The voice of the Russian warship called on them not to take part in the fratricidal war and to choose the right side, promising a social safety net and life in one great united country. Make the right decision. Stay alive. All you have to do is declare your consent on Channel 16 and follow our further instructions. Unload your weapons and cut off communication with your command, was the message broadcast over the International Open Channel for vessels. Sometime later, once the Russian cruiser Moskva appeared on the horizon, the tone began to change and everyone on the island was threatened with death. At that moment, Zmiini Island was perhaps the most vivid illustration of the situation in which the whole of Ukraine found itself, face to face with the enemy, in the middle of a sea of uncertainty and doom. But despite this, at around 6 p.m., all the anger and contempt that had been building up during the day spilled over into the famous message to the Russian ship. A message that was destined to become one of the most inspiring slogans and a true symbol of this war. A message that will be heard on day one in every corner of Ukrainian land, wherever the Russian occupiers set foot. Russian warship, go f*** yourself.